Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your host, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at Steinway & Sons and for the online music magazine, listenmusicculture.com. My guest today is pianist, composer, arranger, and producer, Peter Bentz. His piano covers of pop songs have millions of views on YouTube, and he recently released his debut album of covers and originals, The Awesome Piano, available wherever you stream your music on the Steinway & Sons label. Bentz spoke to me on Zencastr. How are you doing over there? How's your corona life?
Pretty good. Some of the usual stuff, of course. You know, I get to spend some time with my family and my dog. I get to cook a lot, which is one of my favorite hobbies or things to do besides music. And of course, I get to create, which is amazing. Actually, I'm really grateful. We should be grateful to be doing what we love to do.
Let's jump right into it and talk about some of that creating that you've been doing. What I really love about your sound, both on your originals and your covers, is it's so clean and it's so precise. But at the same time, it doesn't sound sterile. It doesn't sound cold. There's so much warmth in your playing. And there's this emotional affecting use of dynamics. And that comes through for me, both in your covers and in your originals. Let's start with the covers first. Your first album is out now on the Steinway & Sons label. It's called The Awesome Piano. It's streaming wherever you purchase your streaming music. When I hear about someone doing piano cover pop songs, I get nervous. I immediately get nervous because my fear is that I'm going to come away from a piano cover saying, oh, okay, this just makes me want to go hear the actual song. I want to learn something new. And that's what I love about your covers is because they're proper arrangements. They're not trying to be literal transcriptions. You don't fall down that trap, and they're just full of inventiveness and originality. So I guess my first question is, when you sit down to do a cover of a pop song, what's the approach? What are your priorities?
First of all, thank you for saying this. And of course, you know, what would be the point of just copying music and literally transcribing something? I mean, there's no real value to it besides you hear it on some instruments. But if there's some level of original ideas involved, I think there's really no point of doing such things. I know it sounds harsh, but if you think about it, you're right. Because if you listen to a different version of a song, of course, it's because maybe you like the original song and you're a fan of the original music itself, but you want to experience something else because you've already heard that song before. You can go to the concerts. You can go to Toto concert and hear Africa, as the encore and rocking out to Africa. That's really amazing on all levels. But the only point of doing covers, for me at least, is to, of course, keep the characteristics of the original song. I don't want to rewrite the thing. I don't feel it's appropriate, and I think I need to have that sort of respect to the original work to follow the main characteristics. But I think everything beyond it, like as you talk about the arrangement, I think it has to be something more original. First of all, for me, the most important thing is that I really have to like the song. Like I have to be in love with a song. And that's how, you know, the covers of Michael Jackson came about. When I was much younger, I had very different musical tastes. Like when I was around 7, I would only listen to classical music. So it was really a huge step for me. And it's kind of like a progress that it's interesting to see how I, became much more open to a lot of genres and everything. And so Michael Jackson was for me the first a real huge eye opener, and I was just so impressed by a lot of things he did.
You've done a lot of Michael Jackson covers. What was it about his music that drew you in?
It's really hard to describe, but I think it has to do something that is rooted deep inside of all of us, something about rhythm, like something that c- connects on a much deeper level. Mostly the rhythm and just how he manifests music with his singing and dancing and beatboxing and everything is just combined into one package that was just so mind-blowing for me. And I wanted to recreate that energy and rhythm on the piano. And it was really challenging. And I think the cover for Bed, I worked on it for over a year. Possibly. I mean, not like 24/7, but usually what happens is I complete 90% of the song in 5 minutes, and I polish the rest for like, I don't know, months, the remaining 10%. It's like it's really hard to let go of something and finally, you know, finish it and say, okay, this is done. And it was the same with the album, actually. You know, if I would listen to something now, like I would say, oh, I wish I had more time to work on this and that.
Let's talk about Bad since you brought it up. To me, Bad isn't even on my top 20 of Michael Jackson songs, but you drew me into this piece. I think because of the way you brought in very sensitively and very affectingly a piece of Smooth Criminal.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the way that organically fits in. And again, you break another rule there, which is, oh no, pop medleys. But again, it's successful because I think of the sensitive way that you bring in that material.
And also, I think I didn't want to opt for the very obvious choices, which would be Billie Jean or Thriller. Mm-hmm. But also, like, it's good that you brought up this point because it's actually my second, I don't know, rule or whatever, that it has to be translated to piano really well. So if I would imagine something, should I do a cover or not? The main question is, how would it sound on a piano? And I think Bed was a perfect choice in terms of, you know, the bass lines, the rhythm, the chords, the melody. You can get everything into a solo piano piece. So that's a huge point. How can you arrange a specific song to the instrument?
The other Michael Jackson track on this album is Beat It. And there you have a really fun use of extended technique to capture all these different textures throughout the song. I'm thinking of the fuzzy tone on the Eddie Van Halen solo, or the use of plucked strings to get that sort of bong, bong bass. And then, of course, the iconic drum beat is there, which is, I presume, you playing with your hands on parts of the piano.
Yeah. That's why actually it's the whole concept of the album, which I call the awesome piano concept, which is that everything you hear from A to Z is like it's 100% piano sounds. It's really difficult at times, but I try to push these limits. And with each video, I kind of think about, okay, so I've done this and that. What else in the piano that I can make sound of and make a good use of and be part of the song in a, you know, elegant way? Or in every of these arrangements, I try to find something. It could be just one sound. Like for Beat It, it was, I think the first time I tried to use the distortion pedal and also percussions and everything. There's always one more element. And until I run out of elements to explore, I'm gonna keep doing these things.
You had an interesting effect, since we're talking about different elements, in your cover of Attention that gives us this sort of post-Drake, drowned, muted sound, a lovely post-techno feel on that bass line.
Yeah, and I think it was do-it-your-own technique, because I wanted to make a kick drum, but I didn't know I could just buy this thing and play the kick drum on this machine. So instead, you know, I think I borrowed from my uncle, who's a percussionist, one of these pedals, and we taped some soft pads or something attached with a duct tape to the body of the piano. And so I would hit the body of the upright with the kick, which was a really awesome sound, actually.
Of course, your Africa cover is the ultimate. It's just a bowl full of texture. There's so much happening.
I love the song to death. Like, I really love basically anything, you know, from Toto. It has such a powerful, happy, uplifting spirit. And, you know, when I do the live concerts, I think it's one of my favorite songs to play because it's just so much fun. I can never get bored of playing it. It's just so much fun.
I wonder, when you play the covers for the album, are there a lot of overdubs? And if so, how do you handle that in live performance?
I have my loop station with me. As much as I can do with the loop station live, I would do it.
Okay.
But sometimes, especially, you know, with the percussion, it would be overdubbed with the sounds that were previously mixed to pop a little bit more, because it would be impossible to mix everything on the spot for the sound engineer, because it's just impossible because there's so much mixing and effects involved. So there has to be some tracks that support what's happening live.
Let's talk a bit about your originals. I really love the Fibonacci song, and I really love the Loop song. And I'd like to focus in on those, because I think those two tracks are a bit related for me, in that the Fibonacci song sounds to my ear new age in the best of ways, a throwback in some way to the high water mark of the Windham Hill label in the United States, but also this very universal new piano sound. Could you talk to me about the Fibonacci song?
Yeah, that's probably the oldest of my compositions that are on the album. It's actually, I think I composed it around 2008 or something, and it was for one of my exams. For a composition class. And then I used the same piece to audition at Berklee in Boston. And so the way I was obsessed with the Fibonacci sequence, trying to bring mathematics and music kind of together. And I was really impressed by the Fibonacci ratio. And so I was trying to find ways how to make music out of it. And actually, now that you say it, about the sound of Fibonacci song, that was possibly my sound at the time. And I would improvise so many things, and it would all sound just like Fibonacci, actually. I mean, something similar to it. And now that you brought it up, I kind of miss those those times. I wish I could improvise more.
Thank you. I bet you could come back to that if you wanted to.
Yeah, because what you said, it's not very definitive in a way of harmony. Like there's no, you can't just say, okay, it's 1, 4, 5, but it's something, yeah, I've never heard it put it that way that you said, this new age. It's interesting.
Yeah, there's a modal quality, right, to that song.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't lock you in.
Yeah.
Let's move to the loop song, not as new age-y as the Fibonacci song, but built with layered loops, a little bit of a Coldplay feel in the best of ways. Tell me about this track.
It's one of the most recent ones. It's pretty much all songs. It came about some sort of improvisations, possibly late at night when I'm bored and can't sleep. I always loved the idea of making strong musical statements that are repeated and kind of catchy, and it just feels good. I love the idea to create music that you can just listen on loop, basically, and it gives you comfort. And it doesn't have to be complicated, but it's something that really interests me in general. In loop song, I think it's one of those, you know, manifestation of wanting to create something like this. It's very easy, basically. You know, you have layer one and you just, you know, start to improvise something and, well, it sounds nice. So you record that. It's, I don't know, 8 bars or 4 bars and put it on Pro Tools or whatever and put it on loop. And you just, you know, what could go with this basic, very basic idea of music, this short period, you just start to improvise more and more. And when you have like up to two, three, four layers, you start to, okay, so now you have the main ideas. How do you build a song for a song that goes for 3, 4 minutes and it's not boring and it develops? So you start with the very basic and you build it up, and then there's something, you know, like a drop and then you start to build something else, which is I believe it's maybe right after 1 minute or something, when I played all 4 or 5 loops in the beginning, and then it stops and you start to build something else, and now it comes up some sort of piano percussion and a new melody and something else, and that builds up too. So there's a second part. It builds, but it's much shorter this time, and then comes another drop, and then for the third time you put everything together, and that's what's amazing to me, and that's how actually Africa works, because I have a small section there that is kind of original. It's, you know, it's like a
that breakdown like section.
Yeah, that breakdown bridge section or whatever. The purpose of that is that you build up something and then you just make 1 + 1 = 2. You put those two things together that you already proposed, those very two different build-ups, and you put it together, and it has to sound something like wow. So that's the trick of doing those loops and making those arrangements. There's two completely different sections. If you throw them together, it has to sound even more epic. And that's how African loop song, for me, it's very similar in that way.
Sure. We think of these as techno strategies, but of course, they're also very old classical strategies. These ideas of disparate A and B sections coming together surprisingly well in a final build.
Yeah. And it's really simple. But you can mess around for ages to get these things right. But it's so much fun. Like it's a great way of creating music that, you know, connects with people.
So we've all heard this myth of, oh yeah, nowadays people are actually growing their followers on YouTube before releasing an album, but you're a guy who has actually done that. Your YouTube channel, it's 25 or 26 videos, but some of them have millions and millions of views. And you put all these out before putting out your album, which is unconventional, but we are being told in the 21st century is becoming more conventional. But my question to you is, how did you do this? How were you able, I don't want to say to build something from nothing, but how did you build this following online?
I think it was really organic, and I don't want to sound like there's some myth behind it. Of course, there's some strategic planning and some decisions not to go onto the wrong direction because it's very easy. It's been amazing and to see how everything develops and the whole process of like a snowball effect, I guess. The more followers you gain, I guess you have, the next time you're supposed to have more surface to send out your message or your music. So it's a really interesting way of growing. I think it's an all-time rule that I don't do things that I don't want to, and I only do things that I would love to, because that's the only way to go. And sometimes people think that there's like a huge team working on this thing, but it's actually two of us, me and my manager Sebastian. From the beginning, we've been working together what kind of videos to make, and of course going along with the flow, like seeing what's working and what not, all the time being genuine and true to the art, and not do things for the sake of just popularity or whatever. And always quality over quantity. That's a forever rule. And also things change so much drastically in terms of social media. It's really hard actually to keep up with everything because it's changing so fast, you know, algorithms, this and that, and how to engage people and whatever. You could hire, I guess, social media strategists, whomever, but it all comes down to being genuine and making quality content, I think, which is really, really important. If you see the videos on YouTube, most of them are not edited videos. And that was really important for us. It feels very natural and something that is more live and more connected to the viewer, actually. When you edit something really go crazy with editing, you know, people know that, oh, of course, you know, you could do anything when you edit the video. You can sell whatever you want, but
it becomes less authentic in a way.
Yeah, but if you can do it in one take, that's a different level, I think.
I think you're right, and I hadn't thought about that, because, of course, you could have just overdubbed 15 different tracks on YouTube of you doing 15 different edits and lots of flashy camera angles, but then we don't get the sense that you're sitting down and playing the piano.
Yeah, exactly.
Peter, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
I really appreciate it. You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Bad, Beat It, Attention, The Fibonacci Song, Loop Song, and Africa, all from Peter Bentz's album The Awesome Piano, available wherever you stream your music from the Steinway & Sons label. Our intro and outro music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, performed on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Fanan, Editor-in-Chief at listenmusicculture.com. Question for the podcast? Message me on Facebook at Soundboard. Thank you for listening.